Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is July 9th, 2004. Today's session number is MES 2004-04. Today's speakers are Sonia Myers and Norma Cromwade. The lesson for today is Call to be Family, but what does that mean? Set your seal upon my broken heart. Families dealing with cancer. Let's listen in.
We're starting.
Well, today our session is to set your seal on my broken heart. And we're really looking at dealing with families who are in the cancer experience. And the majority of American people will have an experience with cancer, either directly within their family or within their extended families. And Sonia, if you want to introduce yourself.
I'm Sonia Myers, and those of you who have been here before know who I am and what I do, but I teach nursing in the School of Nursing at Minnesota State University Mankato. And one of the things that I also do is work on a research team with Norma, and we really have focused on families in cancer of late. Earlier this week we talked about families who are healthy, and yesterday we talked about our study with chronic illness, and today I'm going to share a piece of the research that we've done with families experiencing cancer, and Norma's going to do the introduction to that. And my experience with cancer is families of children who have cancer, and so that's my broad experience in that. I also work in adult health, so I have that, but my focus has always been children with cancer and caring for families who have children with cancer. So.
Yeah. And the stories that we'll use today, hopefully we will honor the people that we took care of, because it's much more than the few people we interviewed for our studies. I've been an oncology nurse for about 17 years, so you're kind of getting bits and pieces of the different stories and people's lives that I've interacted with. Kind of going back to the beginning, since I began working with patients and families for all these years with the diagnosis of cancer, a lot of times people will ask you, how can you do that? Well, when I started working with cancer patients, it was an automatic death sentence. 17 years ago, once you got the diagnosis of cancer, that was it. There really wasn't any chance of you becoming cured. But now that's really evolved, where we have a lot of cancer survivors who are living, and the switch in the healthcare profession is not really to try to cure somebody from cancer. We really treat it as a chronic illness. So that's why yesterday we used a few examples of cancer as a chronic illness, because we really see that even after a person has been maybe cured from that initial cancer, and as they become cancer survivors, there's still a lot of treatments and therapies that a person must undergo all throughout their lifetime. So we kind of have made that big shift from that automatic death sentence to really treating it as a chronic illness. The diagnosis of cancer is still seen by families as that automatic death sentence, though. And that's what we'd like to talk a little bit about today. Even though that we know things have progressed and different treatments have improved dramatically over the years, the cancer for the family seems like it's a death sentence. And that does have some merit, actually, because once that cancer enters into that family unit, that family will never be the same. So their family as they knew it probably does kind of go through that death, because they then have the chance to grow and really develop through this cancer experience as a set of families.
I thought maybe you were bringing dinner. I'm just kidding.
I'll bring seconds at least.
Second, was it good?
And we really want you to kind of think, when I think of cancer and I think of healing, there's physical healing that goes on with that cancer experience, and that's mostly for the individual member of the family that has the cancer. But there's also a lot of emotional healing and spiritual healing that can go on in that family unit. But it's the family who chooses whether to stay kind of in that automatic death sentence or decides to heal emotionally and spiritually along the way. So what usually happens is a person seeking some information. So they think, oh, I have a funny cough here or a funny ache there or something is just making them not feel right, so they decide to go access the health care. And a lot of times they deny that first or couple of signs that show up. And so they're kind of along the way with this cancer experience before they access some type of health care. Sometimes it happens that you're doctoring for one thing and it turns out to be cancer in another spot for people. Sometimes when it's like Crohn's disease, we know it's Crohn's disease makes one more potential to become cancer in the GI tract. So sometimes you're treating Crohn's disease and then it switches to become cancerous for you. So while you're going through all those physical exams, multiple blood tests, x-rays, the various scans, and then the repeat scans as they're trying to validate what you have, all this waiting occurs, and the waiting is very difficult for family members. It's very difficult for the person who's going through the test, but it's all this waiting that really causes one to worry and wonder what's going to happen. Then you get the diagnosis of cancer. It's kind of like the next wave in this cancer experience. Sometimes you get that news directly while you're in the physician's office. Sometimes it's done in a very kind way. Sometimes it's done in an in-kind way, like we heard about the MS lady yesterday, how she was told of her diagnosis. And sometimes it's done over the phone. And this is not an atypical story. We've heard so many times people get a phone call on Friday afternoon and telling them that they have cancer. And it was 6 p.m. and we were just sitting down for our evening meal. The phone rings. I decided to get up and get it, even though it interrupted our weekly roast beef dinner. It is the doctor's office. Is this Janelle? The young voice asked. And I said, yes. Your tests have come back and you have cancer. Please come to the office on Tuesday at 10 to discuss your diagnosis and prognosis with the doctor.
Oh, gosh.
This happened on Memorial Day weekend.
Oh,
wow.
So by calling the family on Friday, we had to wait, and we had no information of which to even go on. So dreams and worries, and by the time Tuesday came, it was very stressful for this family. All weekend, all the fears kept creeping in. We'll talk about fears later on. I really feel that diagnosis of cancer is the initial threat to your mortality. So when people haven't had a chance to really think about their mortality, it's this diagnosis of cancer that really brings that up, that one has to really face and work through. A call from the doctor. Bad news. I have been given my chance at life. I'm 52. I didn't paint those pictures or write those books or become great at anything. But I did raise three wonderful and remarkable children. I have known love and terrible loss. I have known joy, agony, anger and bliss, contentment, resentment, passion, peace, fear, ecstasy, longing, loneliness. I have experienced the full range of emotions. Now I feel a little afraid, alone, because no one can travel the path that lies before me with me. Well, so be it. I will try to get my affairs in order, and I will try to find some comfort, maybe hope, and hope I have enough courage. And you'll find that those elements of hope, faith, courage, and endurance are the key elements to get people through the cancer experience. We used this passage yesterday, but I wanted to just read it to you again. Isaiah 40:31. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not be faint. So it's really through that faith, hope, and courage that you get through this experience. Denial is kind of the next wave that comes up for people. After they've heard this diagnosis of cancer, then they want to deny it. Friends and families are really good at denying the cancer, especially when it happens to someone they love. Denial is helpful, though. Sometimes you think of denial as being a negative thing, but denial is helpful because if the person is not ready to go on or to face that cancer experience, denial is a nice way to keep yourself coping and to keep yourself safe and the family intact. Denial allows you to carry on with your everyday activities and whatever it is that you have to do. And denial lets you have that kind of glue to keep your life together until you're ready to move on. Many cancer patients and families think, well, this can't be happening to me, or this can't be happening to us, or the lab must have made a mistake, or it can't be that bad. Here's a story from a lady who had a recurrent breast cancer. She treated herself through the medical field probably, boy, she must have been coming back for about 7 years. Am I not facing reality, I wonder? If I refuse to face reality, I think I can change reality. If I laugh in the face of disaster, it will change its face. Maybe if I refuse to acknowledge cancer's potential to kill me, because if I admit its power, it would kill me. Oh, she says, perhaps I'm just an optimist. And perhaps in this instant, an optimist is always a bit of a liar. The next wave that I see with cancer patients and their families is blame. When one is diagnosed, it's a temptation to blame others for that situation. Some thoughts are, why did God give me this cancer? Why is God punishing me? And this is a story from a Wisconsin man who was told he was going to die within 6 months, and then told he was going to die within 6 months, told that this was his last Christmas for 2 years in a row. He kept being told he was going to die and die and die. But his wife was very questioning. I wonder why God gave you cancer, she said. And the husband, Gary, got a little upset and looked at her and responded, I can't believe you ever believed that God gave me this cancer or that he is punishing us. Joyce, that is totally wrong. Don't you believe that God is our Father? That means he is our parent. Just like we are parents to Joe, Mike, and Julie. You and I both know we could not love them any more than we love our children. Even though we love them as much as we can love them, they are still going to have things that go wrong in their lives. They will fall and skin their knees. They could get hit by a car. They could get cancer or some life-threatening disease. Even though we love them as much as we can love, that doesn't prevent tough things from happening to them. Like God our Father, we can hug them, be with them in their struggle and pain, constantly reassure them, and give them strength and support. God has been doing that for us this whole time. Even though my getting cancer is part of the human condition for me, God our Father has had his arm around us all this time. He's giving us love, he's giving us grace, and the strength to walk in our journey. The next way that kind of comes is through this diagnostic and prognostic period for families, when the diagnosis kind of continues to be more specified. You kind of get into what cell types the cancer is, what stage the cancer is at, and there seems to be six main issues that families face. And so as we kind of talk about these issues, I'll kind of read the issue and then we'll talk about some stories that we have, and if you have any stories that you want to share about that particular issue, we'll give you time and you're welcome to pop in with your own stories.
Can I ask a question quick first? Beck, about the blame part though. Do you ever find families, have you ever found where they're like blaming each other, or is that not something that happens very often? Like,
They blame each other in situations where they think that it could have been prevented, like you're smoking. It was your smoking, so they blame the person for smoking. That's the biggest one that we see that occurring with.
Mm-hmm. Is there also sometimes like self-blame? Do people blame themselves at times?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I could have stopped this. And now look what my family's going to go through. Many times it's not that they're so concerned about themselves, even. It's now look what my family's going to need to go through because I did this. When there seems to be a more direct link with lifestyle to the cancer, that I think is the key. It does occur.
And it's even harder for people who are very healthy runners, healthy eating, like to the left, like making sure everything is healthy that they eat and exercise. And then when they get cancer, oh, they really have a hard time. Then they're, because they've thought in their mind that they've done everything that they can to prevent the cancer from coming to them. So that's very difficult.
Yeah, and I would say the emotion then that you see is anger, not blame, it's anger.
Is it like, is it sometimes channeled at a certain thing or just?
It's just diffuse. Yeah.
Whatever seems to be a good target. Many times it's the people that love them the most.
The first issue that we like to talk about is that the courses of cancer are unpredictable and prognosis is difficult to determine. As much as we know about cancer, we've learned a lot about the different cell types and how it likes to grow and how it likes to progress. We've learned a lot about how secondary nutrition, the ability of the tumor to grow its own blood vessels so that it can get more nutrients to itself. So we've learned a lot about that, and that's where a lot of our new treatments are going to. And we've learned a lot about how the patterns of cancer occur for patients within families. But still, with all that we know about this much. And so much of it, the care that we give, is still in that kind of experimental type mode, because a lot of what we know about cancer really came out of the Vietnam War, with the using the chemicals, the mustard and agent, orange. And so mustard was used as a treatment therapy for cancer for many years, and it's been refined, of course, through the years. But when I first started taking care of cancer patients, vomiting and the nausea, you felt like they were gonna throw up their toenails. There was just such fierce vomiting. And people don't have to go through that anymore. Things have progressed a long way. We'll talk more about that later. But we were also learning more about the genetic link of cancer, how the family's genetics, and so we're learning more about that. And in your genetic makeup, it really takes 2 hits on a cell to make it turn into cancer. So that's why when they talk about cancer being carcinogenic, that means that cancer makes that cell already have 1 hit. So it only takes 1 more alteration in that cell to make it flip into being cancerous. The cancer journey we know a lot about, and it's very unpredictable as to how people accept it, what their perceptions are about it, how do they communicate it about it, how does their immediate family and friends react and respond to it. Sometimes people react and respond and they can't talk about it. They don't know how to approach the person with cancer. So maybe a close relationship even becomes magnified and distant because they're not sure how or what to say. It's really important to find out what the meaning is given to this cancer experience, because sometimes when I work with Native American people, they think they've been given this cancer experience so that they can become stronger. It's through their suffering that they get more gifts and they are able to then have a better life here on Earth, but more so when they cross over. Having had those sufferings and those struggles, they will have much more character and the ability to have a better life as they cross over. So really, what is the meaning of the cancer in that family is important.
I was just thinking, as Norma was talking about the genetic linkages that we are learning about, those linkages in themselves create challenges for families. Some of you may know of the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genetic links, where those particular markers indicate that this woman may be more susceptible to breast cancer. And so then what do you do with that information? Do you do something permanent about that? If you have that and you have teenage daughters, do you have them tested? How does that work? We have a colleague who on July 16th is having a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy because she's had some suspicious lesions. She has BRCA2, and so she and her family made that decision. That's not easy to do. Not easy to do, but it's because we know that. I mean, it's the knowledge is power, but the knowledge is also presenting some new things for families to consider over time. And she doesn't happen to have any daughters, so that's not a consideration that they will have, but it just presents a new challenge for families, I think, to consider.
The treatments is the next big issue. There's so many different side effects for treatments that sometimes the side effects of the treatments are even worse than the cancer itself. And we have some patients who decide not to do anything with their cancer. They decide just to live the life out as it was given to them because of the treatments and the side effects from those different therapies. And the main treatments and therapies that you come across is the surgical a treatment. If they have a large mass or something, they usually go in and remove it surgically. Then they typically follow up with either radiation or radiation and chemotherapy to the majority of cancers. And the next therapy that a lot of people are now using are biologics. The biologic therapies would be taking a piece of the tumor and creating almost your own personally a concocted chemotherapy or the biologic and reinfusing it back into your bloodstream so that it's going to go and attack that specific cancer cell type that's in your body. It's also what we're kind of experimenting with as far as being able to make vaccines against certain cancer types is through the biologic. Herceptin is a good biologic that we use for breast cancer clients. So, but with these side effects, you know, you have the different ability of your body to heal. A lot of the times after surgery, when you have cancer, it's difficult, it's slow healing for those people. Sometimes they have recurrent infections that come because of the surgical procedures. It seems like every time you have to have re-surgery in that area, it kind of brings people down and makes them a little more weaker and more frail each time. Chemotherapy is difficult because of the side effects, mostly fatigue. The biggest one is your nausea and vomiting. But there's a lot of new drugs that we can give people to help them so that they don't have to have that experience. The radiation, I often think of the people who have mouth and throat cancers. The surgery is very deforming for them. The radiation is very painful, and it affects the structures when they're trying to swallow and even to eat. That at home right now, as right before we left, I have a good friend who's trying to decide what to do with these treatments because of having this throat cancer. I think the other things that are worrisome about the treatments is that people feel, especially if they're kind of more in this healthy regime of eating well and exercising, that they feel in their head that they're pouring poison in their body from the chemotherapy. And trying to work with that is sometimes difficult as a nurse, because we know the benefits of the drugs, and but yet you always have to maintain that the patient's rights and choices are first and utmost. So that's probably one of the more difficult things to help families deal with, as the patient is choosing or not choosing a therapy and the rest of the family thinks that they should go with this or that. So a lot of times the nurse is there to negotiate and advocate for the patient's rights, even though we ourselves may not be agreeing with that. But our goal is to make sure that each patient has the knowledge and the information so that they can make the best choice that they can. And the thing that I hate about healthcare sometimes is sometimes we sell different therapies and procedures in a different way. So this lady who was told about this mouth and oral cancer, they said, well, you know, we'll do the surgery and then you'll do radiation therapy and you might just get a little bit of a sore throat. And I'm like,
don't think so.
Yeah, that is such a slight symptom. We have much more severe symptoms that she's going to hear and have if she chooses to go that way, but that's how it got sold to her. Or maybe that's how she heard it when she was in that presence of the physician when he was telling her. So that's why it's so nice to have a family member with you, because when you're trying to listen to it, it's very hard and you're kind of scattered, so it's nice to have multiple ears there so that you can talk and try to discuss what occurred there. Do you want to talk about symptoms?
Well, you know, what I get into not only in my practice, but also in my church practice, which is kind of like a weekly consultation. We both are in parishes of about 300 to 400 people. We seem to be the people who are consulted in a variety of ways for different symptoms. But I think what's frustrating to me also is when I hear people's stories of these symptoms that last, that continue to last. We're nurses, and so we talk about symptoms very openly. So I'm going to talk about one of those symptoms. Diarrhea is one of those symptoms that happens with after radiation for men with prostate cancer. It happens. It's one of those things that my father had prostate cancer, and so that's when I really first learned how much of a change for the family that all is. Because guess what? They don't want to go to church anymore. They're afraid they won't be close enough to the bathroom. They can't drive far distances because they're not sure how that's all going to work. And it's like that. When you hear symptom, diarrhea could be a side effect. Yeah,
But you don't ever really think of what those kinds of symptoms are going to mean long term. So anyway, it's often what both of us are doing, are managing the outcomes of treatment in our professional and in our church lives as well.
Yes? Yeah. I just wanted to kind of share, if I could,
sure,
about my experience with cancer. My brother, John, is 34 years old, and he has colon cancer. And he got diagnosed, he was out of the country, he had stage 4 colon cancer. They misdiagnosed him there. Mm-hmm. He was in Prague. And then we brought him back, and they discovered, yes, that was it. And I will tell you that it's been really, it's the treatment process that has been just the hardest part of, mm-hmm, you know, just dealing with the imminent possibility of death, mm-hmm, is much easier than this part. I mean,
than the seeing the suffering.
Than the actually, yeah, watch this happen. He's been hospitalized 13 times. He's had 2 major surgeries where they basically cut him from ear to ear, took out half of his colon, and they didn't do that until after they did radiation and chemotherapy. They gave him a colostomy bag, which he now carries. And this guy used to be a fitness trainer and like 6'2", really muscular, mm-hmm, very healthy, and always ate the right things and did everything you're saying. Mm-hmm. And he's withered away to a frail old man. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he's kept his hair, which is interesting, but he has done those things of every time he has more chemotherapy, he gets an infection, so then he gets sick, so then he has to go in for another surgery so that they can get rid of the infection, and it's just this, and every time that happens, it's like down further a bit, mm-hmm, and his bravery is amazing. Like, he'll drive with my mom to go work out. Mm-hmm. And he goes and rides a stationary bike. Mm-hmm. But the effects on him are that he sleeps until 2 or 3, can get up for just a short while, and goes right back to bed. Mm-hmm. And he's had trouble with the whole vomiting and, mm-hmm, and diarrhea thing, but that's, yeah, I mean, it's just to watch that effect of the treatment, and it's been a year.
Yeah. You know, thanks for sharing that with us as an experience, because that's the experience of the family. Looking on, seeing this kind of thing occur, not being able to necessarily stop it. You don't want to stop it because what's causing it is the chemotherapy. That's the hope. But on the other hand, you don't want to see what's happening because it's hurtful and painful and is changing that person into someone that you don't know, into a new and different person, I think. And many of you may know this, but I always explain the chemotherapy, the reason that, and Norma alluded to this already, cancer cells are this aberration of cell, and one of the best ways that they know how, they know how it's our cell that changes into a cell that isn't productive anymore. And this particular cell rapidly reproduces. That's how cancer cells grow, they rapidly reproduce. And so the target of the chemotherapy is to target all rapidly producing cells, which are cancer cells, but intestinal cells and hair cells and mucous membranes, as well as the blood-forming organisms, white cells, red cells, platelets. So he's tired because he's like got no red blood cells that are circulating oxygen, and that's why he's pooped.
They have to do blood transfusions like all the time.
Yeah. So it's like that. It is the treatment that is they
and
take them down.
What's hard about the treatment theory, uh-huh, is that because now he's living with my mom in an apartment in her home, but she take. She's the caregiver. Mm-hmm. And so she goes with him 4 times a week, mm-hmm. usually, to whatever, mm-hmm. treatment, yep. radiation, chemo.
In addition to whatever else she wants to be doing or has
done.
Which
is trying to get her PhD.
Yeah.
So it's like shifted.
Yeah.
So is she still able to, is she still going for her PhD or did she have to put that on?
She's at OSU and she's, which is Oregon State University. The Beavers. FYI. And actually they were going to arrive today and he's coming. But they didn't show up, and so I'm thinking that they're going to come tomorrow, which is nice. We'll be leaving, you know, this group of our family will be leaving, but what I'm thinking is this may be his last trip up here, so it's pretty cool that he is doing this, or maybe he didn't feel good and they stopped halfway or something.
Who knows?
Like that.
Well, we'll keep thinking about you and your family as we go.
This is just so timely, you know, for me.
Well, good.
And I have been the denial lady. I'm just having a normal life, just taking care of my children and going to see my brother, and I'm going to be okay, and you're going to be okay. And we have hope, and we'll pray together, and things like that. But I've been the one of 6 kids in our family to just sort of not feel, because I'm the oldest kid, and I've always had to be the responsible.
In charge of everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, and in control of something.
So finally I started feeling yesterday. That was amazing. So this is really good and helpful, and I go back with that piece of grace.
Good. Thank you.
When Kate is talking, as the person's going through those different treatments, you still don't know where the cure is going to come, because the cure is so uncertain as you're going through the different therapies. The family experience of that uncertainty and wondering if there is going to be a cure that comes with cancer is difficult. And a lot of times you're basing your family history on cancer experiences that are 30 and 20 years ago. So that type of care doesn't exist anymore. So sometimes it's difficult to really get a reality or a clear perspective as to what the chance for cure is for your brain. A lot of times your physicians can't really give you a direct percentage either. They're just trying to identify what they expect due to the patterns of the other people that they've cared for in the past. Pain, I think, is the number one fear of families. And it's also the number one fear for the person that has the cancer itself. Pain is very taxing, and for me there's 3 different types of pain that I see in my patients and their families. The physical pain, which we can do quite a bit about, the physical pain that people are experiencing. The emotional pain that bubbles up through the cancer experience, and also the spiritual pain that the family experiences. And the emotional pain really impacts your family and your friend circle, and that spiritual pain is really a chance for spiritual healing to occur if there's some support there for yourselves. I kind of look at, I spent a lot of time with the Native American, and the Crow Indians in Montana, they talk a lot about this physical, emotional, and spiritual pain. And as long as the pain is serving a purpose, the Crow people are much more apt to experience it and experience that suffering. But it's at that point where the pain has no purpose that you need to think of ways and strategies to get rid of it. So sometimes when cancer would occur, cancer really serves no purpose. So the pains associated with cancer are, you have to find strategies to either heal that emotional pain, maybe it's the call for you to heal a relationship that's been broken, or for you to kind of take inventory of your life. And also, spiritual healing is very much called upon in that Native tradition, to really take the time to heal spiritually. Psalms 118, verses 5 through 6 talks about, out of my distress I called on the Lord, and the Lord answered me and set me free. With the Lord on my side, I do not fear. And I see that this text, written in little placards in patients' rooms quite often, so it's one that seems to be powerful for them when they're dealing with the fear of pain. Another issue that comes up in the cancer experience is just the cost of the medications and the cost of the treatments. I have a man who has bone cancer, and he could really benefit from an injection. The injection costs $3,000, and being on medical assistance, they won't pay for that injection. An injection would take some medication and put it right at the tumor that's in his bones, because he has prostate cancer that's metastasized to the bones. And it has a little bit of radiation attached to it, so it adheres to those tumor sites, and then the radiation would continue to try to shrink those tumors in this man's bone. But because of the cost of that, he isn't able to have a therapy that would benefit him. So right now, they're actually, should have had the benefit while I was up here to try to get that money raised so that he could benefit from that therapy.
He doesn't have the insurance, or the insurance won't pay for it?
He has medical assistance, so he has no insurance. Yeah. And a lot of times your insurance won't cover a lot of therapies and treatments that we know about. And even if people that do have good insurance, sometimes they even choose not to have any therapies or treatments because they know it's going to be a financial burden on their family. And they will just die with their cancer, and we just try to help cover their symptoms as best as we can, because sometimes that's a conscious choice by the families.
Many of the pharmaceutical companies do have compassionate use programs, yeah, too, though. So just because it may not be covered, there are different, yeah, programs that are available for people that can't pay for medication. So I think it warrants pushing the envelope a bit,
yeah,
to try to get compassionate use programs.
Right.
And that's also available for clinical trials sometimes.
Yep, that is true.
Yep. The compassionate use of pharmaceutical companies has really opened up in the last couple years. It's really gotten much better, and it's much easier to access the drugs. I remember Glasgow was the pharmaceutical company. I was working in Montana, and we had a man who had just such severe nausea, couldn't get on top of it. And that was before they were going to start producing. It was still in clinical trials. And we were able to get Zofran for him as out of compassion. They let us, it was the very first test dose that was given to somebody outside of their clinical trials. And just that one dose made this quality of life for this man totally improved. So I hear what you're saying. A lot of times people have negative feelings towards the drug companies, but when it comes to oncology care, they can't be any better. They do a good job for us. Clinical trials are a little confusing to people, so I just wanted to talk a little bit about clinical trials. There's four types of clinical trials. And the first one is just random experimentation. They don't know what to do for you, so they're just gonna give you something, give it a try. So those are pretty nasty sometimes. So if you have a chance to be in a clinical one trial, sometimes it's even best not to even go there. Clinical two they know a little bit more about the medication, so they're kind of playing around with how much of a dose to give you or the sequence of how to do that clinical trial. Those are a little bit more sustainable as a person. Clinical 3 and Clinical 4 trials are really good to get into if you or your person in your family has cancer, because they're really honing down on just tweaking the therapy a little bit. So those Clinical 3 and Clinical 4 trials often get stopped because they see such a benefit early on in the research that they'll stop the research itself and then give the best therapy to everybody that they're treating at that time. So I wanted to talk a little bit about that because that gets confusing. Use of experimental therapies can be quite disappointing because people think that just by kind of giving their body over to this experimental therapy that it's going to be a positive experience for them, but that's not a guarantee. So something to kind of keep in mind if you or your family is faced with that. But sometimes if there's no hope and there's nothing else that they can do, families feel that they don't have anything to lose, so you might as well go ahead and give it a try. The difficult with the therapies is that families always kind of try to figure out, and sometimes they second guess themselves, you know, did we make the right decision for the therapy? Did we make, you know, should we have done this or should we do this? So a lot of that energy and worry about trying to make sure that they did the right decision occurs for families as well. The seventh issue that comes up is loss of function. And loss of function comes from the malignancy itself. And what Katie was talking about, having a big physical brother that you were, you know, always see in that certain image, then just the cancer itself has changed him from that big physical kind of burly type guy to someone who's very frail and fragile right now. And that can occur kind of in micro events, and it doesn't matter, because you can have micro assaults to a person. Like yesterday we read about the person who kept losing the hair on the page, on the dinner plate, those type of things. Every time you take a little hit, it feels like a little bit of life is leaving you. Or you can get an L and a big hit where you're going for a big surgical procedure because of infection. My grandfather had a macro hit. He was diagnosed with leukemia and wasn't treated very well, because that was back 30 years ago. But he died because of a tooth that happened to come through the roof of his mouth. And the physicians didn't know what to do with him very well. Well, that was a big macro hit. So that would be an example of how that occurs.
Because he couldn't fight the infection.
He couldn't fight the infection, and they didn't know what to do at that point in time. We didn't have any of these new growth factors or cell-stimulating things to help with that. Symptom management is probably the last big area for patients, because tomorrow we're going to talk about more end-of-life issues. So symptom management is kind of the last one we want to talk about today. And Sonia's going to talk a little bit about our research, and I can handle things out while you talk.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, good. Well, we talked about healthy families and families with chronic illness, and now we're going to hand out information about a study that we did at the family level. You know, a lot of what we're talking about is at individual cell level almost when we're talking about cancer, but we did a study that was funded by a pharmaceutical company through the Oncology Nursing Society. Many times different companies will fund with an unrestricted grant so that they'll give money to a foundation that supports research, and we were fortunate to be funded for this particular research. And it sounds really strange, doesn't it? The family experience of chemotherapy-induced neutropenia, which simply speaking is the low white count that occurs because of chemotherapy. Now, isn't that kind of a strange thing to do research on? But we did research on that because side effects of chemotherapy often are the things within families that create issues. Certainly, the diagnosis of cancer does, but even after that, then, one has to deal with the side effects. So, we did another grounded theory study, which means we interviewed families, all these family members we interviewed. We had seven family members of seven patients who had chemotherapy and then became neutropenic or had low white cell counts because of that. And we asked them about their experience surrounding chemotherapy-induced neutropenia. And when we do a grounded theory study, we're trying to create a beginning theory about what it might be that we can then eventually maybe test, maybe create interventions for. So the family's experience of neutropenia is that it creates a new vulnerability for them. When they're diagnosed, and they wait, and that's the first really hard part, until treatment starts. Then once treatment starts, that chemotherapy is the hope. It becomes the hope. The chemotherapy, the radiation, the surgery is the hopeful thing. But when counts go too low, chemotherapy has to be stopped because we're really putting that person at great risk. So maybe they're at their fourth or fifth cycle of chemotherapy and all of a sudden their counts go way too low. So that the treatment is worse than the infection, which they of course could die of with any kind of an insult, a pneumonia or a tooth or an ear infection or a bladder infection or an infection at the surgical site, any of those kinds of things, we put them at great, great risk if we continue to do chemotherapy. So we would stop the cycle of chemotherapy at that point in time, but that creates a whole new vulnerability for the family. So the family sees that as a time of vulnerability. During the time of waiting then for the chemotherapy to start, there is a turbulence of the it creates a turbulence within the family. But because of that turbulence, it often creates a time for intensified connection. And we interviewed rural families because we live in a rural community, rural area. The Office of Management and Budget in the United States says anything 50,000 or less is rural. So that's where we are. But we have, lots of distance that people travel to their treatment. And because of the ruralness, they had to do some creative things to intensely connect with their family members just to kind of get through this, to kind of process what this was going to mean, this stopping of the chemotherapy. And as a result of low white count, these individuals were much more susceptible to infection. So what the family did was enact some caring strategies. The family caring strategies were family inquiry, family vigilance, and family balancing. Family inquiry was a lot like you might expect. They would go on the internet, they would look up information, they would find ways that they could help their family member to raise the white blood count, whether it was nutrition or whatever that might be. Maybe there are some growth stimulating factors, and that's part of the therapy that has really helped to decrease the amount of low white blood counts is the new kind of tissue cell stimulating factors, and the family member might learn about how that's going to work for their family member. And family vigilance is all about being vigilant about people coming into the home or the individual in the family going outside of the home and being potentially infected with something. So families would do things like not go to salad bars anymore, public salad bars, because those are a rampant source of potential infection. And not go into crowded areas, not go to the movies at night, but maybe go to the matinee together. I remember one of the women talking very clearly about her sadness that she couldn't get together with her ladies at church because she just didn't know who was going to be sick and who wasn't going to be sick and all that kind of thing. And she also told a cute little story where she had gone one time, and she felt like she was coming up, and her counts were coming up, and she was doing really well. But one of the other little ladies came into the group and said, "Oh, I've got a cold, I'll go home." And so the church community also was helping her through the treatment process. One really tough one was grandparents who wanted their grandchildren to come visit them, but they couldn't because they were a real source of potential infection. So they did a lot of this. Grandma did a lot of phone calling, a lot of emailing, a lot of connecting that way, but being vigilant. One family talked about when anybody came to visit, they went through and cleaned the toilet, washed the doorknobs, did the whole house disinfection kind of thing, kept the home kind of immaculate during this period of time. So you can see how this becomes a family experience, truly a family experience that is happening. And then family balancing, which of course we talked about with our healthy families, but the family balancing here was to balance between protecting and then and still having enough fun, enough stimulus, enough family time. And it also was, we had one family that was really irritated with their family member because she wanted to continue to go to work. Only her accounts were so low that they knew if she went to work, which she happened to work in a hospital setting, that she might get infected. But this was a young adult who wanted to work. And so there was this struggle within the family of, we want her to be able to go to work, we want her to be able to be the responsible young adult, and yet we don't really want her to go to work because we are concerned about her going and that kind of thing. So through this whole process, the family, I told my family today as we were hiked to Heart Lake, and we saw how the stream, there used to be a stream that went under the bridge now, and the bridge is just sitting there now and has no stream under it. The stream has totally shifted. It's a new place, but it's still a stream. And that was it was kind of a metaphor for what I think families go through. It's like this torrential downpour that happens, I think. And the bridge that used to work maybe doesn't work anymore, but a new stream gets created. And it's a new way that families operate. And through the time of those caring strategies, there are some really cool things that have happened for families. Some of them are creating new relationships than they ever had before, and it's over something like low white counts, which is pretty amazing, I think, in those general terms. I'm going to pass around for you just this was in Anaheim. We presented this, Norma did, as a poster. And we've also presented this in Toronto at our nursing research conference in a different way. Should I do that? One of the other things that we did, okay, so this is the diagram. Let's see, did you get this?
Yeah.
Did they get this? This has these little circles that has more specifics about how families did the inquiry and vigilance and balancing. And then the piece of paper that says figure two, we've just gotten an article accepted. This one?
Oh, I didn't pass those out. I didn't think we were going to talk about those.
Well, I'll talk about them.
As long as
we
got them.
You guys take care at home, then we don't have to. This is, I always want to show you, so why do we do this kind of research? The reason we do this kind of research is so we can create better interventions, better ways to do care. And so under each of family inquiry, vigilance, and balancing, there are some suggested nursing approaches that we could utilize. So we can talk about that afterwards with somebody. And then the last thing that I'm going to show you is that these kinds of ways in which we present research are fine, but they might be boring. What we know in research is that it takes about 20 years from the time research is done until it actually gets into practice. And 15 to 20 years is approximately. So one of the things that we did, because we had some grant funding this time, was to commission an artist to do an interpretation of our research findings. So I'll pass that around, and this is the artist and us interpreting what the family's experience of neutropenia was. So that's just an example of what we wanted to, and we wanted to get that out so that other nurses, primarily nurses is who we've worked with now, and those nurses at both of the conferences responded in such a way that we knew they knew this potentially was the experience, and there could be something different done in nursing care related to that. So.
Yeah, we can kind of wrap it up. I think I'll wrap it up with kind of an excerpt of the life after cancer treatment. And this is from a lady who had breast cancer. "My life has utterly changed. And through these massive changes, what has happened to me? Am I different? Perhaps. I have certainly learned much about myself, life, prayer, people, and the power of love and laughter. And I have discovered that throughout my deepest grief, my anguish, my illness, the experiences of sublime peace, love, tenderness, and goodness have been ever available to me. Thanks be to God," she says. And another source of hope for some people is Psalms 116, verses 8 through 10 and 12. "For you, O Lord, have delivered my soul from death, my eyes from tears, my feet from stumbling. I walk before the Lord in the land of the living. I kept my faith even when I said I am getting afflicted. How can I repay the Lord for all his goodness to me?" Would you please join me in prayer as we finish this session? O God, who gifted families with the charisma of devotion and the capacity to care for the sick, teach us to pray. Bless all caregivers with the gift of devout and fervent trust as we lead our patients and families into the experience of illness or infirmity. Send your spirit of wisdom and understanding to guide our minds and our hearts as we seek to support the fragile bodies and spirits of those who must walk in the valley of cancer. Instill in all family members the elements of faith, hope, and prayer. Help us to discern how to live our lives fully. Grace families dealing with the cancer experience with an enlivened devotion to you. Amen.
Amen. Yes.
I just finished stage 2 protocol with the Tuxin and Marvin, and went through Boston at Dana-Farber back then.
Oh, good.
I it was interesting, your opening as far as how I was contacted. It was a message on my answering machine.
What is the deal with
that? It's astounding to us. I have to honestly say, if I could apologize for all of healthcare, I will do that. And I will continue to do that.
They didn't say I had cancer. They just said the doctor would like to see you. Mm-hmm. That thing and that. So. But and with the white, because of the fludarabine and the rituxan, the
yep.
low white blood count, and that, that's one of the things that they monitor. And I went down about 19, mm-hmm. and that, which is low, but not down the basement.
Yeah. Yeah. Our people were all 19 is 1900. Our people in their study were all 500 or less. So.
Yeah. I think low, you know. Supposedly, you don't want to be much below 30, 30,
right.
30.
Right.
But it was about a 7-month protocol. The one complaint I had in the protocol is that I did it through Seattle, but it was a Boston protocol.
Mm-hmm.
And the complaint I guess I would have was that the doctor, Dr. Steve Treon, didn't follow up as closely as I was expecting to, he used me as one of his numbers.
Yeah.
Essentially.
I'm sorry you had that experience. I have had patients who feel like a number or feel like they've been slotted into that. And that it happens sometimes when you're not being housed in the place where the direct study is being done.
I went back to Boston 3-4 times for bone marrow biopsy and stuff.
Yeah.
But he also has a very good doctor in Seattle.
Yeah, my doctor in Seattle is fantastic.
Yeah, I sit on the institutional review board for our local healthcare facility, and that's one of the things that the physicians and the nurses on the team all are very fastidious about. Was many of us, you know, are part of multi-site studies, so that the protocol does come from Boston or whatever, but we write into our protocols exactly who the contact person is and how that person is going to be followed up. And it is hard. There are a lot of different variety of that kind of thing. So, but thanks for sharing that.
But
yes,
we're friends with Bill. We go to the same church.
And
we've known for a number of years of this. Many people in our congregation didn't know Bill's cancer originally. This man has had a fantastic attitude. And I think attitude has so much to do with it.
Yeah.
He has not given up. I mean, he has fought this unbelievably well for a long time.
I was, when I went in 2 days later, and Ruth went with me in that, and he said what he thought what it was. It's called Waldenstrom's. It's a very, very rare, it's named after a dumb Swede. The doctor had already scheduled a bone marrow biopsy and which was good because that's something that I don't really want to do. But literally, I walked out of his office across the street
for
a bone marrow, which was great.
That was a kind thing.
But he did say one thing, and I asked him, well, how long do I have to live? He said 3 to 5 years. And I was 7 years old. Wow.
Yay! Thanks.